The last case set for argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Keaton Vanderweide. Christy Jones is appearing for the defendant. Mr. Vanderweide will be arguing, and Chelsea Wenzel is appearing and will be arguing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Ms. Jones, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. You can proceed, Ms. Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. I want the court to consider one question today as we look at this case. In what other criminal case is a defendant prohibited from telling a jury about specific detailed information of the event in which the crime is accused? That's exactly what happened here today in this case. Here, the circuit court applied the rape shield law so broadly that instead of it being a shield to protect the victim from having her unrelated sexual conduct paraded before the jury, it was used as a sword against Vanderweide in order to prevent him from putting on his defense of consent. If the court would like, I'll give a brief rendition of the facts and then get into the argument. In this case, there's not a lot in dispute. The parties agree that there had been a long-term relationship, they shared a child, and that a sexual encounter did happen in this case. The nature of that sexual encounter is what's at play and at question in this trial. The alleged victim testified that this was a non-consensual encounter, that he had raped her through penile penetration. There was one charge at trial, and it was one count of rape. She indicated initially that there was only penile penetration, later then to state that also that there was anal penetration as well. However, only one count was still charged. Additionally, she also said that sex toys were not involved in this situation at all. She denied repeatedly to law enforcement that sex toys were part of this encounter. However, when pushed further by law enforcement, she did eventually indicate that at one point the defendant did grab a sex toy and tried to use it, but that she grabbed it from him and threw it in his face. In contrast, the defendant's story remained consistent. He consistently said, "This is a consensual encounter. We had had a fight before. This was makeup sex. And this was a consensual encounter, as is our history and our common practice." He indicated that at some point during the encounter, the alleged victim received a phone call and that she instructed him during that phone call to go to a different room, grab these sex objects, and to come back. He did so, and that's how he knew that this was a consensual encounter. It was common in their history to use these sex toys in their practice, and nothing was out of the ordinary for him. In preparation for trial, the circuit court waffled a few times on whether or not these sex toys could come in. Additionally, the state waffled a few times on whether or not they would elicit information regarding sex toys from the alleged victim. Ultimately, the state indicated it was not going to submit or elicit this testimony from the alleged victim. The defense then sought to bring up the information regarding the sex toys to prove consent. The circuit court barred the defendant from doing that. In barring the defendant from admitting that sex toy evidence at trial, the circuit court misapplied the rape shield law as set out in section 412. I submit to this court that the rape shield law was misapplied in two ways, with two specific words in the statute. The first word, other, and the second word, or. Initially, the statute requires that evidence of sexual conduct, if offered to prove that the victim engaged in other sexual behavior, is prohibited. As the state argued in their brief, they indicated that this was other sexual behavior. Because the state did not need this particular evidence in order to prove their case of penile penetration, it was not a material fact and not subject to admission. It was other acts. However, Your Honors, the case law does not indicate that that's accurate. Other in the case law indicates prior, unrelated, different sexual behavior. That's not talking about the sexual behavior that we have here. In this case, this is not other sexual behavior. This is the sexual behavior for which the defendant is accused of participating in.
Your argument is not so much that it was misapplied technically, it doesn't apply at all.
I think that's fair, Your Honor. I think that it does not fit the initial phase of the statute requiring other sexual behavior. And I think case law supports that. Most case law in South Dakota talks about things that happened other than this incident or prior to this incident or sexual conduct with other parties or other allegations. Nothing about prohibiting the defendant from talking about what happened during the encounter.
Except that two times during your argument, you mentioned that he also wanted to say that as was our prior practice. So those are talking. So he wants to talk about the fact that they use sex toys on prior occasions. Is that not excludable under the Rape Shield statute? And why not?
Your Honor, I don't think that's excludable under the Rape Shield statute. When the defense's consent, the defendant gets to talk about why he knew that she was consenting. What has been the history? What actually happened? All of those things are important to prove consent. And in this case, the defendant wasn't even allowed to tell the jury what actually happened during this specific encounter.
And in fact, didn't the court actually allow in some testimony with regard to their regular practice?
That's
outside of this particular event.
That's correct, Your Honor. There were several motions put in the 412 hearing, some of which the court granted and some of which the court denied, some of that being their history regarding tumultuous relationships, having children together, that they had a sexual history together, that they had been a couple for a very long time. So the court did look at other information and decide this does come in under the Rape Shield law. There's nothing prohibiting this evidence.
And I was thinking more specifically, and maybe I'm wrong, that there was also a discussion about related to the act here, that there had been a history of penile penetration, for example.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think what the court is referring to is that this couple had been together for about 4 years, that this was not an uncommon situation for them. In fact, the very virtue of this encounter, that the victim was supposedly moving out, but then this was a reconciliation, that was common for their relationship as well.
The court talked about the prejudicial effect of this evidence on a number of occasions throughout the pretrial proceedings. What probative value here outweighs the prejudicial effect?
Your Honor, this is the most probative evidence that the defense can put forth for his consent case. This is evidence that is extremely compelling because this is evidence of her dictating to him to go to a different room and proactively get these sex toys to come back and use, as is their normal history. This is the evidence of consent. The defendant can say she consented. But if that's all he's left with and can't go further and explain why she consented, how he knew she consented, and what way she consented, he can't put on his defense.
Well, that was explored fairly heavily during his cross-examination and of the cross-examination of the alleged victim as well. I mean, ultimately, isn't it a credibility determination for the jury?
I think that's one part, Your Honor.
We have seven witnesses here primarily. You know, we have the defendant and the alleged victim and several other law enforcement witnesses and the same nurse.
That's correct, Your Honor. Really, the question at trial comes down to essentially the one witness and probably the defendant and her credibility. There were no other physical evidence that was brought into trial to prove that this rape happened. There was no physical marks. There was no indication of force. There was no issues within the apartment that would indicate a scuffle happened. There was no other physical evidence. So really, we're left with a story of what she says versus when he takes the stand and puts on his defense.
So there's a qualitative difference in your view between saying, as you said in the final lines of your reply brief, saying, yeah, there was consent, or there was consent, and let me tell you why. I know there was consent.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. The defendant did get to say things like, this was our history, this was normal for us, we had a volatile relationship. But when we're talking about the defense of consent, the best evidence, the most compelling evidence that he has is her directions to him during the encounter.
And the jury can believe it or not.
Correct, Your Honor. And it's possible the jury may not believe it, because my guess would be is the state's going to cross-examine him as well. Which leads me to the next issue. Because the court took this evidence out at trial, the defense was no longer allowed to appropriately cross-examine the victim in this case, who also made inconsistent statements about whether or not these sex toys were involved in the incident.
So that was a credibility issue that was created by cross-examination. And ultimately, as you say, that's interior to that principal ruling of whether he can say, hey, this happened.
Your Honor, the initial error happened in the application of the rape shield law. When the court prohibited this testimony from coming in and prohibited the defendant from putting on the consent testimony, it led to other rulings that quite frankly led to an absurd result. Now, at some point, the defendant can't even cross-examine the victim about credibility issues, which credibility is the only thing at stake here.
All right, flesh that out for me a bit, if you would. How would the cross-examination have changed, in your view? Because this goes to prejudice.
Your Honor, there were several statements made both to law enforcement, excuse me, and representations made in court about whether or not the victim agreed there were sex toys involved, to what extent they were, and she had made those different statements. So when we're left with a case where there's zero physical evidence, and I'll note for the record, the victim said he will have physical evidence on him, there should be scratch marks. He had nothing. There was no physical evidence.
You brought that in through cross-examination.
That was brought up. But when he's specifically prohibited from talking about things in which she is making inconsistent statements and her credibility really is the only thing at play, that's extremely prejudicial.
So what questions would you have asked her that you were prohibited from asking about, in particular, I guess, the sex toys, right?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that questions regarding the first statement she made about sex toys not being present, and then continual statements to law enforcement about sex toys not being present. And I will also note for the court, defense attorney, and I was not trial counsel, but the trial counsel tried to go into those lines of questioning and dance around the court's order, understandably, because it was a difficult order to deal with, dance around that order and ask her questions, well, did you grab anything from him? Because she knows from other motion hearings that the victim said she absolutely had this sex toy and grabbed it from him, to which she denied, which is what started a sidebar and then a later colloquially by the parties saying, we get to talk about this. This is cross-examination. And the circuit court blatantly saying, you don't get to talk about this. If the state doesn't need this as evidence in their case, you don't get to talk about it. That's not the standard. That's not the standard at all. We don't only bring in evidence that is helpful for the state's case and the defense is out of luck. The defense also gets to put on his defense. Repeatedly in this case, the circuit court made statements that if the state is not bringing in this evidence, defense, you don't get it. I don't think that that's what the rape shield law is for. The defense has a right to put on a defense. In this case, it was consent. And by prohibiting him from doing that, the trial court completely hamstrung his whole entire argument. You can see it on the record. When he got up to testify, he was flustered. He was frustrated. He was confused. What can I tell the jury about if I can't tell them about this little snippet that happened during the alleged event in which I'm actually accused? So I do think that there was extreme prejudice in this case. I think the court misapplied the rape shield statute. And I also think, as I stated before, not only is this not an other act, this is the act, this is the related sexual event. So rape shield probably shouldn't have been applied to this evidence anyway. But even if this court thinks that rape shield does apply, the trial court repeatedly seemingly added the conjunctive instead of an or in regards to who gets to put the evidence in.
Counsel, I want you to move quickly to your text messages argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly, if I may, And I will note that the record is a little unclear about what all happened with it. The text messages never got into the record. What ultimately happened is the defendant was cross-examined on a stack of text messages that were not complete in nature over the repeated objections from the defense attorneys saying, this is not the complete story. What essentially happened is on cross, the state's attorney handpicked, cherry-picked some statements to paint the defendant in a specific light. And because of prior rulings made under the rape shield law, the defendant could not put those in proper context.
You did not offer the packet of text messages?
I was not trial counsel.
Right, counsel.
They are not in the record.
Defense counsel did not offer the packet of text messages so that the court can see them in context.
The packet did not get entered into evidence in any way in the record. I think that that was probably a little bit of a chilling effect from the circuit court saying, hey, there may be some issues in admitting these. From what I can tell in the record, I think the circuit court was worried that further criminal charges could be assigned to the defendant if these got put into the record. The state's attorney already had them, so if there was going to be criminal charges, it was going to happen. I think that admonition by the judge probably chilled defense counsel from putting those in.
But how do we as a reviewing court now evaluate this claim as to prejudice if we can't see what it was that you wish your client could have been able to put forward in response and determine whether that's prejudicial error?
Your Honor, I think that I would love to see the text messages as well. I'm not exactly sure what was in them. What I can say is that there is a record of completeness, and because of prior rulings, because of all of the context of this case and the way that the court was ruling against the defendant on the rape shield law, these text messages did not get put in their full, and that in and of itself is a violation. See, I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Wenzel, you may proceed with your argument.
May please the court, counsel. In this rape case, the legal questions are narrow and the facts matter. The couple in this case, or the defendant and the victim, had a tumultuous relationship for several years. They had a child and they lived together. Prior to the rape, they had broken up. The victim had packed her things and she was moving out. On the morning of the rape, the defendant and the victim were talking on the couch. The defendant leaned over to kiss the victim. She said no and walked away. Defendant pushed her down and pulled off her shorts. She was crying, saying no, and trying to get away from him. But he pinned her down and penetrated her with his fingers and his penis. The victim reported the rape to her friend and then to law enforcement. And based on the victim's allegations of penile and digital penetration, the defendant was charged with rape. Now, in this case, the defendant did claim that the victim consented. Before trial, he sought to admit evidence, and the court admitted evidence of the couple's prior consensual sexual relationship, their history of fighting, bickering, and then engaging in reconciliation, which would end in what the defendant called makeup sex, and the history of using certain sexual positions that were also used during the rape. But here, defendant also sought to inject unrelated sexual behavior between him and the victim with others.
And how is it unrelated behavior when it relates to his version, which is, you know, certainly different than what the alleged victim's version was? How is that unrelated behavior if what he was trying to introduce was behavior regarding this particular event that resulted in charges?
So it's other sexual behavior for two reasons. First of all, and I think as Justice Myernan pointed out, this wasn't just the behavior or the sexual behavior on the day. He also wanted to bring in the probative value, if there was probative value of this evidence with sex toys. It also came from the couple's history of using sex toys in the manner in which he was claiming they did. So
would that be prohibited under the rape shield statute? Testimony about this couple's prior relationship and use of sex toys?
Here, yes, it should have been prohibited.
Why?
Well, the rape shield statute, the words of the rape shield statute say that the statute applies to proceedings that involve alleged sexual misconduct, and that it prohibits any other evidence having to do with the victim's sexual behavior or predisposition. So that's the important word, alleged sexual misconduct. Here, the alleged sexual misconduct was penile and digital penetration. So any kind of alleged penetration with a sex toy has nothing to do with the sexual misconduct at issue. So it's immediately excluded under that statute.
Let me take you back because I diverted you from Justice Devaney's question. So the victim got to testify. This is what happened to me that day. The defendant didn't get to testify. This is what happened that day. He was restricted from testifying, giving his version of the events. Isn't that fundamentally unfair?
No, Your Honor. The defendant was allowed to testify about what happened that day, and he was allowed to talk about why he thought the victim consented. I think it's important, and I think it was brought up in the first argument as well, that in the reply, there's a difference between saying, I know she consented, and I know she consented because. Here, he was allowed to say, I know she consented because we had a prior sexual relationship. We had used these certain sexual positions before. We always fight, and then we make up by engaging in sexual intercourse. This is exactly what happened here. He was able to talk about the history of the relationship, the frequency of sexual intercourse. He was able to talk about how they were working on their relationship and they were still being intimate.
But he wasn't allowed to testify. We used sex toys during this particular incident.
No, he was not allowed to testify.
Then later, when she was under cross-examination, the defense couldn't cross-examine her about her statements regarding the presence of sex toys.
No, the defense was not allowed to cross-examine her, but I would also disagree with defense counsel's characterization of the victim's statements. If you go back and look at the police report, her statements to police about the sex toys were internally consistent in that report. The police asked her after she said...
Well, that's your assessment. Don't they get to raise that to the jury and let the jury make that assessment? Hey, and then you get to go up and say... These are consistent. These aren't wrong. And this defense gets to say, no, they're not consistent. And then the jury says, we believe the state, we believe the defense. They didn't get the chance to even do that.
No, Your Honor. That's because what she said to the police and what she said in trial were not inconsistent. And that was a ruling that the trial court made. The trial court does have the discretion to look at an alleged prior inconsistent statement and determine if that statement was actually inconsistent. And here, the trial court said no. She looked at the context of the questions that defense counsel was asking. She knew about the police report. And she said, no, this is not inconsistent with what the victim said.
So, Ms. Wenzel, I want you to assume for a moment that it was error for the court to exclude that testimony of the sex toys. If that's the case, you know, this is two people talking about consent, no dispute, the act occurred. Why is that not prejudicial in terms of his ability to put on that evidence of what he claims occurred that day?
Because he was still allowed to present his defense. And when this court looks at whether a defendant's right to present a defense was violated, they look at what he was able to present. And here, again, he was able to talk about parts of their sexual history, their history of, what I would call makeup sex, saying that happened here. He was able to contradict everything the victim said.
But this ruling fundamentally changed what this defendant could say about what happened. It had the effect of changing the facts in the case, did it not?
I don't think it did. The state's position is that he was still able to put on a defense. He was able to talk about the shorts. The victim said, well, he ripped off my shorts. And the defendant said, no, we both took them off. In fact, he held up the shorts and said, look at the fabric around this waistband. It would be impossible for me to rip these off.
So let's say he developed all those, and otherwise defense counsel did what defense counsel could do. The chief's question may be a good one. This case was close. Maybe this additional ruling could have impacted the result.
Again, I would disagree, respectfully, of course, because here the sex toy evidence, especially, for instance, with cross-examination, this wasn't bringing out bias. This wasn't going to the victim's motive. This was a very, very small part of his defense. And again, it couldn't have been used to attack her credibility because it wasn't inconsistent with what she said to police. And
well, was it a small part of his defense? His defense was she's lying. She's not telling the truth about what happened. So isn't every fact important for the jury to consider in terms of the credibility of the witnesses?
Well, here, the circuit court determined that this could not, this statement, this one statement could not be used because it was not inconsistent. And that's something that this court reviews for an abuse of discretion. The trial court is allowed to look at the context of the questions and all of the other evidence to see if this was an inconsistent statement.
As if it never occurred. But of course, he says it did occur.
Right. But again, I would direct you back to, there's two things. First, I would direct you back to the statute. It says alleged sexual misconduct. And in State v. Lycan, the court said, when talking about the relevance of other sexual behavior, we have to look at the sexual behavior must be similar to the acts that occurred during the rape. And in Lycan, this court relied on People v. Zisk. And in People v. Zisk, what did that court look at? They looked at the charged offense. Here, the charged offense is rape, and it was by penile and digital penetration. There was no charges of use of a sex toy for, I mean, that was not the issue before the jury.
But in those cases, were there cases where the defendant was seeking to introduce other evidence related to the same series of events that led to the charges? And was prohibited from introducing that under the rape shield statute?
The cases like Lycan are a little bit unclear, but what is not unclear in those cases is that the defendant was trying to bring in other sexual behavior. And what did the court look to? They looked to the charges and they said, this is what happened during the charged events. This is what happened during the rape. So whatever else comes in has to be relevant to those charges.
Ms. Wentzel, what about this? Let's say the facts are just a little bit different. And let's say the victim said there was penetration, penile digital penetration, and with a sex toy. And the state says, yeah, we're just going to charge two of those. We're not going to charge the sex toy. So you've only alleged two. Then what happens?
I mean, I would say our facts are different here.
No, I know they are. But assume they're the way I have them. And the state selectively makes the decision that it's going to charge only certain of these offenses. And in so doing, manipulate the pieces on the chessboard a little bit to make sure that some of that evidence can't come in under your theory and under your argument, or so it would seem.
And I think in that case or in that situation, had there actually been penetration, like if that was part of the allegations and the state did make that decision, that could be a different result, right? That would be.
But that's your as alleged argument for the text of 412.
Under these facts, I don't think that there has to be a hard and fast rule that sex toy evidence can never come in or that the defendant can never tell a story that's different than the victim's. But that's why we have the trial court, right? That's why they are the gatekeeper of evidence. So they can look at the rules of evidence and they can balance the defendant's right to present a defense with the issues that are protected under 412. And that's exactly what the court did here.
But what he said, what his defense is he's saying, I can show you members of the jury, what he wanted to say to the jury is, members of the jury, I can tell you that she consented because she said during this act, go to the other room and get these sex toys and then come back, which I did. And because your argument is that because the state didn't charge anything involving sex toys, that he doesn't get to tell that part of the story. Explain for me how that works.
Well, I think the first question is always is, what's the question before the jury? And the question before the jury is, was the penetration in this case, the penile or digital penetration, was that consensual?
The question before the jury was, did she consent to the sex? That's his defense. She didn't consent. That's what he's trying to show is consent.
Yes. And he was able to show that. He was still able to put on his defense. And his defense was not just consent. It was also that she had a motive to lie to keep him away from, or to keep him from getting custody of their child. So again, it wasn't just the sex toys were a small part of his consent defense. They were a small part of his defense. He had two aspects to his defense. And also, I think the practical effect of allowing a defendant to introduce collateral conduct collateral sexual conduct that's not related to the allegations would make the rape shield statute meaningless, because then a defendant can come in and say and bring in any and all prior sexual behavior between him and the victim just by saying, oh, well, it happened on that day, even if the allegations have nothing to do with that. And I think That is the problem. And again, that's why we have the trial court. And so the trial court can look at the situation and say, okay, here are the rules of evidence. Here's the defendant's right to present a defense. Here's what 412 is trying to do.
But even under that scenario, let's say the idea that the defendant sort of cooks this up in order to, whatever, bring in some of the stuff. As you say, we do have a trial court, and the trial court can put limits on that and restrictions on that. That didn't happen here. The trial court said none of it comes in, cannot say your version of the facts. If, however, things were different and the court had said, yeah, you can say that, but I'm not going to let you go into all this other stuff about this history, the number of these devices, their size, all this stuff. The trial court presumably could have exercised its discretion and put some limits on that. So it doesn't seem like it's an all or nothing proposition. But under this theory, under this ruling, it very much was. None of it comes in.
I mean, how I would characterize the trial court's ruling is, here's all the stuff that you want to put on for consent, and I'm going to limit this little part. So I would make this closer to Krieger, or I would bring Krieger in. This isn't Dickerson where he was completely not, or where he wasn't allowed to bring up this other event that established a separate motive or a separate bias. Here, this was a small limit on what he wanted to put in for the part of his defense that had to do with consent and why he knew it was consent.
Counsel, the text messages here could certainly be deemed to be incriminating. Did the court err in permitting cross-examination of these text messages?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The defendant was the first one to bring in text messages. In his case in chief and on direct, he brought in snippets of snippets of text messages between him and the victim. He admitted when he brought them in that these could be misleading and said, yeah, we thought about whether to bring these in, and we decided to, knowing that they could open the door to other text messages. That is exactly what his counsel said at the time. And then on direct, he also opened the door to other types of relationship issues, which the court had kept out. And here, there was a lot of questions about, well, the texts aren't in the record. Yeah, the whole packet of text messages is not in the record. And that's because neither party wanted that packet in, nor did the court, because there was incriminating stuff for both sides. But here the court kept the cross-examination narrow. And I think it's important to note that both the state and defense agreed that this packet wouldn't be put in, but that that the state would be allowed to cross on it. And finally, I see I'm out of time, but the defendant was allowed to use this packet to cross to and provide any other context. And with that, we would just ask this court to affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wenzel. Ms. Jones, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Salter, I want to pick up on a point that you had just briefly made. Because of the court's 412 ruling in this case, it permitted the state to play the game entirely on their own field. The state got to dictate whether or not the defendant got to bring in the best, most compelling evidence in his defense, and whether or not to save their victim from a challenge on her credibility. The state chose not to put this evidence in because the court ruled that if the state doesn't bring it up, if the state doesn't need this, then it doesn't come in. To read the statute to only allow evidence to come in if the state is first submitting it, one, violates the statute, and two, leads to absurd results, which then leads to a snowballing effect of rulings such as in this case that, frankly, don't make sense.
Sometimes, you know, there is something to that argument. That as argument has some force. For instance, in the source of semen cases. So if the state doesn't, you know, put on evidence concerning DNA or something like that, then source of semen is not an issue. Defense can't put it in issue because it's not alleged. So I understand their argument, but this might be different.
I would understand that argument, too, if there was no subsection B in the 412 statutes. Subsection B specifically allows evidence that maybe otherwise would not have come in to come in if he's offering consent as a defense, which is what he's doing in this case. This is not, Your Honor, other evidence. This is not, so this, the state makes a distinction without a difference because the case law is not distinguishing other prior unrelated, even the Liken case cited by the state, is about evidence of a days, weeks, months prior sexual encounter between the two. It had nothing to do with the events of the actual alleged rape.
You're arguing sort of a res gestae theory.
Your Honor, this is, yes, and it doesn't even need to be res gestae. It doesn't need to be subsequent admissions. It doesn't need to be anything. It is the facts. It is the event. There's no case law that I could find and that the state could point to that prohibits the defendant from telling the jury what happened during the alleged crime. There's no case law that I could find for that.
So Ms. Wenzel argues that he got to present his argument about consent, and I think she said it was a very small part that the court kept out, essentially saying there's no prejudice here, so tell us your point of view.
Your Honor, I strongly disagree that the evidence that was excluded was the most compelling for so many reasons. The difference between saying she consented and she consented because I know she asked me to go get the sex toys, as we typically do. I went to get them. She then allowed me to use them. Oh, and by the way, my statement is corroborated by the third-party witness that called in at the time when this happened. Oh, and by the way, it's also corroborated by the law enforcement testimony of what was found in the apartment, where it was found. That is the most important evidence he can put in to his defense of consent.
I suppose the idea that the defendant can manipulate this a little bit by saying outrageous things that the state and the victim find to be untrue has to be tempered with the fact that the defendant has to waive his right to remain silent and get up on the stand and testify and be subject to cross-examination, which doesn't happen all the time, of course.
Correct, Your Honor. In order to put forth this defense in this case, the defendant did have to waive that right. He got up at the stand, and if the court reads the transcript, the testimony that he was given was frustrating for him, to say the least. I think.
Well, he violated the court's motion in limine a couple of times, which, I mean, in all fairness, you're categorizing it as frustration, but it appears from a cold reading of the record that the defendant simply kept pushing the topic, and the court admonished him, I think, twice.
I think the court did admonish him in front of the jury. What I will say to this court is that for a defendant to be told that he cannot tell the jury about the facts of the case, what is he supposed to say?
And this is where we resolve that. You don't just violate the court's order.
Which I will point to a prior motion hearing in which defense counsel asked for clarification. Can you clarify what this is? And the circuit court at that time said, no, I'm not saying anything further on that issue. The defense was left without the ability to know how far he could go or what he could say. He doesn't know how to tell his story without being able to tell the story. And by the court's ruling in this case, by the way that the court applied the rape statute so broadly, it prohibited from putting on the best defense that he had. It hamstrung him. It allowed the state to dictate what evidence was or was not coming in. That is a clear violation of the statute, his constitutional rights, and resulted in evidentiary rulings down the course of the trial that led to an absurd result. We're asking this court to find that the circuit court erred, to reverse, remand, and set this case for a new trial to allow him to introduce his evidence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. That will conclude the court's October session.